So you go from poverty in Harlem, you know, trailer park living in Oklahoma, success in the Army, corporate leadership in global companies, and then running for governor. All of this seems like almost impossible.
We get off the Greyhound bus in Harlem, New York. We're held up in broad daylight. That was the introduction to what my life was like in New York City. Just because you're poor doesn't mean it's okay to steal.
That's right.
And just because you're poor doesn't mean you can't get an education. Even as a young boy, I mean, I would see the guys on the street corner. I didn't want to be one of those. I saw maybe one or two people. I said, I could live like that. But I didn't know how. But I knew it started with an education.
Stories stir the soul.
Stories reveal.
And stories heal.
In this podcast, we will give you an inside look at someone who's had a life-changing breakthrough.
Real people, real stories with real breakthroughs. As a health and wellness expert and coach, and Todd as a men's mentor,
we've seen firsthand what God can do when it comes to a breakthrough. So lean in, listen well. This could be your biggest breakthrough.
Hello, and welcome to Your Biggest Breakthrough. I'm your host, Wendy Pett.
I'm Todd Isburner.
Yes. And if you have ever been in a place of thinking that your circumstances define you or the chaos that you've been in defines you, well, think again. After this episode, I believe you will think again, because we have on our show today Kendall Qualls, and he is a results-oriented leader that strives to unite Americans regardless of background toward a shared history and a common set of beliefs.
Yeah, he began life in dire poverty in the projects of Harlem, New York, and then later moved to a trailer park in rural Oklahoma. And despite these challenges, Kendall worked his way through college. He went on to become an officer in the U.S. Army and then earned 3 graduate degrees, and then became global vice president of a Fortune 100 healthcare company. All that from a little boy growing up in Harlem and an Oklahoma trailer park.
Yes. So it has not defined him, I'll tell you that. Kendall Qualls is our Republican candidate for governor of Minnesota 2026.
But just, this is not a political podcast.
No, it's not. Okay. But I mean, hey,
you're going to hear about Kendall's story and how it can motivate you for your needed breakthrough.
Yes. And he has been married to his beautiful wife, Sheila, for 40 years. And they have 5 kiddos and grandparents of 2 boys. And he's also the founder and president of the nonprofit foundation called Take Charge, which is an organization that promotes the promise of America and that it's available to everyone, regardless of race or social standing.
Yeah, his message has reached millions of people as a speaker. He's been a guest on Fox and Friends, the Dennis Prager Show, and then several other national and regional radio programs. And along all with that, he's also authored this book that Wendy's holding up if you're watching on YouTube, called The Prodigal Project. Now, I zipped through this thing in about 2 days because
it's
such a fascinating story to see what he went through and how he was determined to push through in all of these different breakthroughs. So you can pick that book up, by the way, and really ought to. It's a great read.
Yeah, definitely do that. You can learn more and get that book at KendallQualls.com. Enjoy the show. Well, welcome, Kendall Qualls, to Your Biggest Breakthrough. It is awesome to have you here.
Todd, Wendy, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
You know, I mentioned you right before we started recording. I feel like I know you. You have to give me that book because I read your book,
Yes, we
The
did.
Prodigals.
So good.
This Prodigal Project is a very inspiring book, but it gives a real look and a deep inside look at who you are. And I'm amazed. I want our listeners to tap into what I got the privilege of learning about you. You have just this incredible story of breaking through all these barriers that would seemingly stop most people and typically do. But so you go from poverty in Harlem, trailer park living in Oklahoma, success in the Army, corporate leadership, in global companies, and then running for governor. All of this seems like almost impossible. So let's start with kind of an overview of your life and what it was like growing up and how you managed to make the right decisions in the midst of all those circumstances.
Yeah, you know, it is, when looking back on it now, obviously it was the God story. But at the time, I'm just going through life, trying to figure out day by day. You know, I don't remember much of my childhood pre-first grade. You know, my mom and dad obviously were married. I was one of 5 kids on the younger side. But the first, I would say, dramatic moment I just remember is when we were living in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, my father's come back from Vietnam War. And then all of a sudden he leaves and we're on a bus, a Greyhound bus to New York City. All of us. My mom just has this constant sorrow look on her face. Hmm. And, you know, one of the things that's just a stark memory in my childhood, and it's to this very day, we get off the Greyhound bus, we take the city bus in New York City in Grand Central Station to 125th Street in Harlem, New York. And this was in the late 60s, early 70s, when it was, crime was at its worst, drugs. And I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, literally, you're not in Kansas anymore, you know, coming from an army base. But right before we get to our grandparents' apartment, and my mom just brought us there, we're held up in broad daylight.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm a kid and I'm just looking, I'm holding my big sister's hand and I'm just looking around. I'm sure someone's going to do something. Hmm. Nothing. And my mother pleads with this guy, please, mister, this is all the money I have. And I have five kids. So I just remember just this guy leaning over saying, lady, you better give that man all your money. He doesn't care if you have five kids or 10 kids. And that was day one, New York City. And that was that was the introduction to what my life was like in New York City as a child.
Yeah, that kind of set the tone, didn't it? Wow.
It definitely did, yes.
Wow.
Your mother was such an anchor in your life.
I love your mom.
She just was this incredible woman of commitment to make certain she provided for her family. Just to back up for
strong
a second.
So woman.
Your dad just basically left the marriage.
Right.
So here's mom with five kids in Harlem. Take us to the next steps of the journey and how that impacted you as you were in those growing up years with your siblings in this crazy place.
Your dad just leaving.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of times, especially, you know, when you're kids, you don't understand the inner workings of marriage and what was going on at the time and all that. But at the end of the day, I'm going to tell you, it took me a long time in my life, my adult life, to forgive my father for abandoning our family, my mother, in the worst time you could have. You know, basically, she's in middle-aged, five kids. And she was one of these mothers back then where she didn't have a driver's license. All she wanted to be was a mom to raise her family. I mean, literally, when I came home every day, it was almost like she had an apron on. It was that kind of motherhood, right? Yeah. Now, here's a mother that's from the Jim Crow South, didn't get a high school education, but had the common decency enough to teach her kids manners. Know the right for, just because you're poor doesn't mean it's okay to steal.
That's right.
And just because you're poor doesn't mean you can't get an education. And be, there was high expectations. We weren't poor in character. Mm-hmm. And so this is why, you know, I fight back a lot about today's narrative. But anyway, that was her spirit. She wanted the best for her kids, and she expected the best from us.
That's so good. So that probably falls in with the faith that you have now as well. Does that start with your mom?
We rarely went to church, though. She had that as that inner core. And I don't know if she couldn't just find a church, that type of thing. But, you know, we were on public assistance, public housing, and she got a part-time job. I mean, you're almost trapped. Once you get into that public assistance world, you're literally in the trap. And so I just remember going to school, and this is in elementary school, just probably 2 or 3 days fighting just to defend myself.
Wow.
This is elementary school. I tell people if I would have stayed in Harlem, I would have been a welterweight champion by middle school, right?
just because you had to be.
Had to be, yeah.
Because you had to be. But unfortunately, my mom was in and out of the hospital from just health, distress, and burden.
Stress.
And I just remember when she would put us to bed at night, she had a constant furrow on her brow just from, you know, the stress and the weight of the world. Hmm. And it just felt terrible for her. Unfortunately, my older brothers and sisters were getting absorbed into the street culture at the time in the late 60s, early 70s. And so my father came back to pick me up and my younger brother to live with him. And we moved to Oklahoma. And he was a drill sergeant in the Army. He was paying alimony, child support. So all he could afford was a trailer park in Oklahoma. And so I lived with the sternness and discipline of a drill sergeant father from fifth grade onward. But I had the love and nurturing of my mother when I was in, you know, from birth to fifth grade. So I had two of those parents, but they were never together.
Wow. And what a stark contrast to go from Harlem to Oklahoma.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I grew up in Texas and now in Minnesota, so I understand even that kind of starkness. But yes. Wow, Harlem to Oklahoma and a trailer park, and then also with the strictness of your dad.
Yeah, drill sergeant.
Yeah, so when did you get to see your mom anymore? Did you talk to her?
In the summers, we got a chance to go back. You know, it sounds like, you know, almost like a fairy tale distant time in our country, because at the time we didn't take a plane back. We took the Greyhound bus. I don't even know if you can see Greyhound buses anymore. Right? But we took the Greyhound bus back home in summers, and great to see my mother. But I tell you, whenever I went through the tunnel or when I went over the bridge, my physical disposition, everything changed. It went into like war zone mode, because you're going into the city and you just never know what's going to happen. Violence, it is literally the strongest person in the community. It is like the law of the jungle kind of thing. Mm. And so great to see my mother, but always on guard.
Yeah. So you're bouncing back and forth to two incredibly different environments. You've got your part of your siblings are being absorbed into the culture of drugs and violence and whatnot. So what was it about you, Kendall, as you look back, were you wired differently? What was it about you that kept you on a straight path?
Yeah, you know, it's something I see it in my own kids, although they're born from the same parents. You know, you see the physical similarities out there, but they're different. They're just really wired differently. Again, the beauty of God's nature. But here's the thing for me. I was an observationist, I would say. Even as a young boy, I mean, I would see the guys on the street corner that would accost all the women at the end of the month when they get their monthly welfare checks, their social security checks. But I didn't want to be one of those. I didn't want to be that. I didn't want to be that. I don't want to do that. I saw maybe one or two people. I said, I can live like that. But I didn't know how. Didn't know how. But I knew it started with an education. That's the one factor I knew. And that's what I did. I focused on getting an education. You know what? I didn't want to be one of those drug addict guys. And here's the other thing. Back then, a lot of guys shot up needles and heroin stuff. I'm afraid of needles. I hate needles. I'm like, how could these guys ever do this? I could never be a drug addict. My hands would shake. I could never get the needle in.
Oh my gosh. That's great incentive right there. I don't want the pain of the needle. That's one way to go about it.
That's good. That's good. Well, you're just such a reminder, Kendall, that our environment doesn't have to define us or what we've been, you know, caught up in with our families. It doesn't have to define us. We can choose a different route. And that's exactly what you did just by observing. And so you knew that education was the ticket, the way out, so to speak. How did you know that? Did someone mentor you there, or did you have a teacher that you looked up to? How did that shape up?
Well, you know, it was a huge emphasis for my mother. You know, she actually sent us to like the after school programs in Harlem. Where they help with vocabulary and all that type of thing. So it was an emphasis. And she always said, education is your pathway out.
Oh, okay.
And I always had this curiosity about God. And, you know, I can remember she and I were walking once, and I would just ask her, hey, where did God come from? And she goes, Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And, you know, he was born. No, not him. I'm talking about the big guy. How did he get here? And I had to probably be 6 or 7 years old. Huh. And I don't know if, you know, that yearning for God or asking for, you know, I don't know if he found favor in that. And I don't know, but I always had that curiosity. So I have that dotted line connection back there, but education was it. And look, I wasn't a great student. I was above average. Because I had so much stress and worry and everything else going on in my life. None of my parents, went beyond high school. My father later went back and got his GED. But the whole concept of studying and all that stuff was foreign to me. But again, I worked hard.
Persevered.
And I got help. And so that's what I did.
Yeah. You didn't have any real good family model to look at. In other words, you, as you're growing up, you couldn't say, well, I want my family to be like this, right? Because your family's so dysfunctional. And we're talking to a lot of listeners who came from very dysfunctional families.
Might be in one right now.
And yet it seems like it provided some motivation for you to want to have a good family that could model. So God brings into your life this beautiful woman,
Sheila.
And I don't know if you want to talk about that. I mean, I found it fascinating that, you know.
Let's talk about how you guys met.
He brings you this woman and.
It's interesting. So both of our parents retire in pretty close neighborhoods. I'm in literally 5-minute walking distance from each other, and we're in high school at the time. And
Oklahoma?
We're in Oklahoma.
Okay.
We're in Oklahoma, and I met her I was with another friend. I met her in the garage, she had this t-shirt on. This was in the late 70s. She had this t-shirt on. I said, Sheila, too cold for words. I said, ooh, what does that mean? her brother got it for her. I'm like, I don't know what that means. Yeah. But anyway, you know what? The friend that I got a chance, who took me to, we were seeing her brother. He wanted to take her to the prom, but he was too shy to ask Sheila himself. So he asked me, hey, Kendall, would you ask Sheila to go to the prom on my behalf? And I said, sure. He was a good friend. I said, sure, I'll ask her. And so I tell this story all the time. I said, so Sheila, Cedric wants to take you to the prom. He's a nice guy. Would you consider going with him? She goes, no, just to tell him thank you, but no thank you. I felt like I owed him a second effort. And so I asked him again, listen, Sheila, Cedric's a great guy. He drives a Ford Mustang GT.
Look out.
He's selling them.
You're going to go in style. You're going to get there fast. She said, no, that's okay. I don't want to go. And so at that point, I think I fulfilled my fiduciary responsibilities. And I stepped out of that role and I said, well, Sheila, a little birdie told me you're free for the prom. And
opportunistic.
Seriously.
And I tell people like Paul Harvey used to stay on the radio. Now you know the rest of the story.
Mm,
but we went to the prom together, and we went through high school, and we broke up a few times, got back together. That's the kind of high school stuff. But I tell my boys now, ever since they were little, find the right woman, she'll make you a better man.
So good. So good.
Yeah, and it definitely goes both ways.
So you, for sure. So you marry, and at that time, I believe you were in the service. You were serving in the Army.
Yep. I was 22. She was 21. Yep.
Babies.
On active duty, and we bought our first house together 6 months after we were married.
Incredible. Yeah. So good.
So after serving, how many years did you serve in the Army?
Yes, sir. Served 5 years on active duty. I was an artillery officer.
Yeah.
And so I traveled stateside, and I did a 1-year unaccompanied tour in Korea. So I was served right on the DMZ in South Korea.
So I'm guessing both through your education and the experience in the Army, God really started to develop your leadership skills. Were you thinking that at the time? Were you thinking God's making me into a leader? He's got plans for me that...
Not at all. Not at all.
Okay. All right.
And in fact, at that time, I wasn't a Christian. I hadn't come to the church or come to the faith. I believed in God, but there was no relationship. I wasn't pursuing him or the church. Neither was Sheila. I used to go to church with her in high school with her family, and only because I wanted to be around her.
Of course.
We weren't looking. And so when I got my first job outside the Army, Sheila was finishing up her master's degree in Oklahoma and living with her parents. And we normally would come down. She would come down on weekends in Dallas, and, we would hang out. But it was a huge ice storm that week. She couldn't make it. And so one of her friends, the family friends, invited me to church. And the only reason I went was because it was a family friend. I was like, oh, gosh. I said, and I told Sheila, she would talk to me. She said, whatever you do, don't join the church. Don't join. I said, don't worry, I won't.
And never say never.
Right. And when I went there, I had never heard the Bible taught that way. Okay. Not preached. There was no entertaining or anything. It was a Bible teaching church. And Tony Evans was the pastor. And it literally changed my life. I mean, his message that I'll never forget, it really changed changed my life. It hit me really in the heart around what was going on in my family, my past family. I wind up attending that church for over a year, got baptized in that church. And due to my corporate moves, we had Max Lucado was one of our pastors. But then we had Joel Stoll. Joel Stoll was a DTS grad, but yes. He was at the time in Chicago. He was, used to be the president of Moody Bible College.
Right.
And we just had some great discipleship.
So apparently God put you on the fast track for really understanding
I'd
the
say
Bible.
So.
Yeah, I didn't know any of these teachers. People. I didn't know who these people were.
Wow. Yeah.
Amazing. So about how long were you attending Tony Evans Church before you fully get like I'm on fire for Jesus and let's go and definitely
it,
a follower?
It was almost instantaneously. It really was. Because I was going through really a lot of anger issues that I had with my father. I mean, I was still angry with what was going on. In that, I mean, I was the only one in my family really accomplishing anything. Right. Only one of my siblings that stayed married to one spouse. And, you know, I was fine with never talking with him again. And you know what? God can't use someone that's hurt, broken, and angry.
Amen.
And so what this church did, I wasn't even a member yet. They took me through counseling on this. I'll never forget the book I read. It was A Search for Significance. They had me read through that. And part of this was writing a letter to my father, explaining all the hurt that he did to me, my family, how I felt about it. And at the end, literally forgiving him,
beautiful,
putting the letter in the envelope, but never sending it. But by sealing that envelope, it put all the hurt, pain, and all that I had really in that envelope, and when it just disappeared, all that hatred. And I wind up having a relationship with my father afterwards, still because God still has them. You know, one of the Ten Commandments is honor. He didn't say love them or like them, but honor them
because of
their positions, right? So I honored him. He wind up, I mean, I could go over his house and, you know, he was remarried at the time and go over his house and we spend an hour in the house, Sheila and I, and then we're an hour in the driveway because he wants to talk to me in the driveway about the family, but he doesn't want to talk to me in front of his, you know, my stepmother. And his. And so we wind up having a relationship with him. I did. And it was almost therapeutic for him to release a lot of the, I believe, the hurt and not animosity, regret.
There you go.
Because of the life my siblings were living, his children were living because of his decisions.
Yeah. And he probably carried a lot of shame, guilt, all kinds of things. And so the power of forgiveness on your end helped him to come into a better place with what he was dealing with. So
can I just flip the question?
I just want to know what Sheila was thinking once he gave his life to Christ so quickly.
Yes, we're going to get there next, but I got to flip the coin for just a second because there may be some dads that are listening or even some grandfathers and things are not right with their kids, even into their late adult years, and they don't know what to do about it. Kendall knew what to do reaching out as a Christian to his dad. What about the dad who might be listening right now, Kendall, who knows he's failed, wished he could have done a better job? What would you tell him in terms of how to make it right with his kid?
Oh, you know, that's a great question. That's an easy one. Because I speak to a lot of ex-prisoners, you know, and tell them, look, your identity is not ex-con. You know, God has an identity for you. But one of the things that you can do, and you feel like your life might be over, it doesn't matter. You have children. If you have children, let them know that their path doesn't have to be your path, right? And that their identity doesn't have to be yours. But also, you know, reach out to them and ask for their forgiveness, that you weren't the best dad that you could have been, that some of their decisions are a result of what you did in their lives. And I believe, and really, these guys responded in such a positive way because it relieves the burden on these kids. That it gives them a chance, maybe an opening door that they wouldn't have taken otherwise, to look at their life and themselves. So they have a huge opportunity if there's a strained relationship.
Yeah, that forgiveness really is.
Yes, open that door. Open the potential to open that door again.
Yeah, it's the key that opens that door to the heart and allows everyone to heal. So it's so right. beautiful. Okay, so let's go back to Sheila for 5 seconds. As the woman, I just want to know. She's like, whatever you do, don't join the church. But here you go. You go and you go one time and you feel the Holy Spirit stir and you feel the healing that's happening and you're like on fire for Christ. Well, what do you say to her after you go to church and this all transpires?
Yeah, I called her back as soon as I got, you know, went to church. I said, Sheila, you got to come. You got to come. This place is different. It's different. It's not what we're used to.
Yeah.
She reluctantly went to visit the first time. She agreed it wasn't like it looked. She went a second time. And after that was all in. We were all in together.
Wow.
And we said, whatever we do, we're going to look for Bible teaching churches. We don't care what color the pastors are. So we went to Tulsa. And I don't know if we have time to talk about this.
Sure. We got plenty of time.
So we went to Tulsa. And we got to find a good Bible teaching church. We went to the Black community in Tulsa. We couldn't find one. And so they didn't have the internet in those days. So we went to the Yellow Pages.
That's good. Yeah.
And but what we wanted was a pastor that went to Dallas Theological Seminary for you know, the teaching and all that. So we found one, a Bible Fellowship Church in Tulsa. Bruce Ewing was the pastor. We still have a relationship with them today. And this was literally 40 years ago.
Wow.
And we went in. And we walk into the front door. We're looking at the, so everyone's back is towards because they're looking at the pastor up front. And we said, holy smoke, we're the only tall people in here.
Yeah, that's good.
But we went. We went. And this is right at the time of, you know, another riot, a George Floyd riot at the time. We said, maybe we need to mentor in our own community. I wasn't willing to compromise the teaching that we've gotten before just so we can be comfortable. So we went back and those people embraced us like brothers and sisters of Christ, like, you know, like they're taught in the Bible. And we joined a small group and we've developed relationships and we have our first child and dedicated at that church. And it became our families were shocked.
Yeah,
I bet.
How dare you? They're going to treat you terribly. They were fearful, all this. I'm like, look, you know what? You know, we walked in faith. And we I'm so glad we did. And we've never regretted it.
Yeah, that's so cool. Real quick, I was just thinking, you know, the family's thinking and on fear. Like, they're going to treat you terrible. How often is that happening? And that's what's causing so much of the division. The fear that we're going to not be kind to one another. It's horrible.
Well, you know what? If you look at Bible scriptures, you do a word search. There's fear or do not fear, do not be afraid. 365 times in the Bible, one for every day. And it's amazing throughout scripture how God always tells, do not be afraid. Be courageous.
Right.
Do not, you know, from to Mary to Joshua to, you know, all throughout scripture. Do not be afraid. Be bold and be courageous.
That's good.
Love that about you, Kendall, too, because rather than sort of give in to your fear of like, well, what will other people think? We're the only Black couple in this white church. And then rather than worry about that or be afraid of that, you just stuck to your decision and your conviction. I need to have the Bible teaching. And I think that's just so profound because it's easy to compromise in areas where we're either uncertain or we're afraid. But again, God seemed to give you the strength and the will and the determination to stick with your convictions. So I want to ask you, because in all the roles that you've played, you're husband, you're a father, you're a business leader, you've run for office, you're an army officer. In that journey up to this point, all along the way, is there any unexpected twist in the story that you weren't prepared for? And how did you react and how did your faith play into that?
Besides your whole life story, but
is there any one particular incident where it's like, all right, I didn't see that coming and you really, really had to lean into your faith?
Yeah, there were two. And you know what? One of those was even before this idea that when I became a formal Christian, when I consciously accepted Christ, this was before, before Sheila and I were married, you know, I tell this story in the book. And when I'm like, wow, you know, I've graduated from college. I'm an army officer. I've got a little sports car. I got some money. now a lot of people are paying attention to me here. You know, the very attractive women are going, wow, this is, I've never had this happen before. And I did something that is probably the worst. It's selfish. And I admit this in the book, selfish, hurtful, just complete. It's shameful. And so I basically told Sheila, you know, maybe we should call off the wedding and just make sure that we're doing this right. Just wait for a while. All the while, because I was attracted to the attention that I was getting. I mean, we were engaged to be married. And I mean, it broke her heart. Hmm. And so we went on that. Maybe several months had gone by, and I'm out every weekend, and a good friend says to me, you know what? You're with a different woman every weekend. You wouldn't know, and the right woman came along. Hmm. I can't tell you that guy's name. I couldn't tell you what he looked like. But when he said the right woman come along, I said, wait a minute. I thought about that, that right woman did come along. And you know what? Maybe I should go back and see if she would forgive me. Hmm. Because she was the right woman. Hmm. And I did that. And I had to humble myself and not just to her, apologize to her family, her brothers, everybody. And it wasn't easy. It took me months. But so that was a twist.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were actually just talking about that in our prayer chairs this morning about the lure of just worldly things and
so
being sought
distracted.
After and easily distracted. If we don't have high level accountability, and maybe that guy, you don't know who he is, but maybe he was an angel in disguise, you know?
So tell me about the other twist you were thinking about.
Well, yeah. So right now I'm in the corporate world. I have this job where I'm recruiting people to launch this mega brand that we're going to launch in the marketplace. So I'm a regional vice president of sales. So I'm hiring managers so they can hire sales reps. And we have literally a third of the nation. So from a financial standpoint, probably about $400 million, responsibility. We're hiring 60. So we hire these people. The product that we launched, it wasn't as good as a product in the marketplace as the R&D team said it was. So the physicians are not having the response to the patients as they thought we were. And now these individual people that I've hired, they're very grateful they hired. Some are relocated and I got them special accommodations. Now they turned on me because they know there's accountability. I've never had that happen before.
Huh. Wow.
Where, I'm not the problem. It's Kendall. And so they colluded together to protect themselves. And they turned on me. And I had never had that happen before.
Wow.
Now, 6 months later, they all were fired for their lack of performance.
Mm-hmm.
But they saved themselves only 6 months. But I've never interacted with someone where they would have a lack of ethics,
mm-hmm.
but that they would actually do something like that.
Yeah, of course you won't experience any of that running for governor.
None. That's preparation, Kendall.
When people say, "Well, you haven't been in politics before," I say, "Well, you never worked for a corporate company, corporate America, right?"
Right, right.
Oh,
well, hopefully you're.
It's training ground.
It's training ground. It is, and nothing's wasted. You know that. Well, as you know, you've written this book, The Prodigal Project, and it's an incredible, incredible message that people need to hear. How long ago did you write it? 4 or 5 years ago?
No, 2 years ago.
Just 2 years ago. Okay.
Yeah.
And people can get this just on Amazon or wherever, right?
The Prodigal
and
Project.
I highly, highly recommend
it. Big time.
But you talk about, our divided culture and different things in there as well, not just your story. But let's talk a little bit from your faith and leadership background. How did we get here? How did we get here? And what's the one thing that could begin to bring us all back together? I know that is your heart.
Yes.
But let's talk about that.
Yeah. So before we talk about how do we get it back together, how do we get here? Let's put some context to this, right?
Yeah.
So you think about up until 2002, racial dynamics in the United States were progressing very well, so much so that the Pew Research Center, they do a survey every year that shows race relations in the United States. In 2002, race relations were either good or very good for 70% of Americans, Black and white.
Wow.
70%.
That's not talked about.
No.
That's right. That's right. It wasn't until 2013, the second term of President Obama, that we start seeing a stark decline below 50%.
Wow.
Now, no, I mean, when I present this, no laws were changed to put Black people in the back of the bus or any of these other things. What's highlighted at this time is look at the disparities, the financial disparities. And this is where I blame the church, the American church, because we started adopting this social justice narrative, which is all off course. There's huge disparities between Black and white Americans, financially and everything else. But when you take out the fatherless home issue, if you look at two-parent Black families that have raised their kids, there are no disparities. The academic achievement, the interactions with law enforcement is the same as the bell-shaped curve of the normal population, the broader population. And what we've gone to in our lifetime, in my lifetime, we've gone from 80% two-parent families in the Black community to 80% fatherless homes without one national initiative to reverse the trend.
Yeah, wow.
Not one.
And there's even incentives for single moms to stay single, correct?
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. So there's financial incentives with our welfare system and all that. But as I look at that, I said, this is not Democrat Republican issue. This is good and evil. God, and when I go in our communities, I say God did not intend for women to raise children alone. And when I speak to people, every head nods up and down in the Black community. And when I share, our prisons are full of angry young men, violent and angry young men wishing they had fathers growing up. Mm-hmm. And so I started to go to organizations like the NAACP, the National Urban League. I started going to some of these, national Black pastors and conferences. This is the issue. Why haven't you tried to reverse the trend? Why don't we have a national campaign instead of a million man march? How about a million marriage march?
I love that.
We need to restore marriage.
Amen.
And then when I started to realize, they didn't want to talk about these other issues. You know what? This is, especially for these non-Christian organizations, NAACP and others, Black Lives Matter is another one. They don't care. They don't want, literally, when I say they don't care. Because it's a political issue that gives them power, wealth, and status at the expense of the people they're supposed to serve.
Mm.
Now, I call that out, and I seriously call that out, because there's not been one initiative to reverse the trend. And when you look at their websites and you say what are the issues they're focusing on, none of them are on fatherless homes, marriage, or anything. It's racial climate justice, it's gun violence, and all this other nonsense. I don't know. It's not gun. The gun doesn't jump up and do violence, right?
Right.
And so, what we've done is started an organization 5 years ago called Take Charge to address this issue, debunk the narrative of white supremacy and white privilege and all of this, and really get our churches back on this issue of biblical teaching, is that when you look in Ephesians, we're all one in the cross. We're not Jew. We're no longer Jew or Gentile, male, female, right?
Yes.
Slave or free. We're one in the cross.
That's right.
I was treated like that at some of these churches. I mean, the model is there. Be bold and courageous to do it and speak out against this false narrative here that we need to be more sensitive. We need to understand the Black issue. Today's Black culture is not Black culture. It's a disruptive, hip-hop, violent culture created out of the mess of LBJ's war on poverty that changed the whole culture from 80% two-parent families to 80% fatherless homes.
It's out of pain.
And you are striking the nail on the head, man. And I very few people hear that or get that. And I'm guessing that's part of the reason why you've decided to run for governor, because our culture is really confused right now. And as so many people believe, no, this is just a race issue. And you said, no, it's a family issue. It's a biblically grounded family issue. And so talk a little bit about that decision that you made to run for governor. You ran once before. You've had a little time out while we've had a different governor in office here in Minnesota. But now you've decided to run again. You want to walk us through that? Like, what happened that you made that decision?
Yeah, without getting your audience confused on inside baseball stuff, so how this political process works at the state level. So we have an endorsement process, and we can decide as candidates, are we going to abide by the Republican endorsement process? So there's just about 3,000 delegates, and the 3,000 delegates decide, here's our recommended candidate for the Republican Party for the state. That's how we do it here in Minnesota. I got in late, and a lot of people encouraged me to get in late or get in at, because they didn't believe that the six candidates that we had already on the slate could win statewide against Governor Tim Walz. And so I prayed about it. Sheila and I prayed about it. And one of the things that would just got me going on it was I could help the violence in our city.
Yeah.
New York City, I wasn't young enough to help. I saw it, and I saw how saw the voiceless that were getting maimed and killed, and they had no help. I wanted to do that because Minneapolis was never Detroit. It was never Chicago. It used to be one of the safest cities in the country.
Yeah.
The safest city. So I ran, and I quickly, month after month, I shot up from the back. It was like a Kentucky Derby. I was coming from behind, and at the convention, the state convention, I was leading for five rounds. So they do a round. So I'm like, almost like musical chairs. Every time there's a vote for the delegates, the candidate with the least amount of votes has to leave. Mm-hmm. And there was just two of us. But the third guy that left, this was number three, just left. He came into my war room. He said, look, I'll endorse your candidacy, and we'll go on stage and we'll raise our hands together. But I want to be your lieutenant governor. I didn't have a lieutenant governor slated at that time. He went in the other guy's room and said he offered the same thing, but he already had a lieutenant governor. So he wanted another role. He wasn't ready for the role. I said, no, I'll give you another position other than that. And he said, well, our campaign manager has been talking about it because at the end of the day, I make the decision. He was not the right guy to be on ticket. He went on stage instead of just giving an endorsing speech for the other candidate. He went on stage to all the delegates. Kendall Qualls is a liar. He's a cheat. You can't trust him. He's a sellout. He offered me this position and took it back. Without getting into the mix of it, the other candidate won the endorsement. He went against Tim Walz. We lost the governor's race. We lost the Senate. We lost the House. We lost the attorney. We lost everything. And this is why we had Tim Walz as our vice presidential nominee candidate in this time around. At the time of that election, majority of Republicans felt we had the wrong guy at the top of the ticket, that I should have been on top. Yeah. Sheila and I were confused. We thought this is exactly what God had wanted us to do. And it was the timing. God's timing is the issue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so if you know your Bible stories, David was anointed by Samuel as king for Israel, but he didn't receive the crown until decades later.
Yeah,
That's right.
And so this is a timing issue. We got a chance to see what kind of governor he is. We got a chance to see what Democrats would do if they have control of the House and the Senate. And I believe that this time around, because we are really a centrist state, even moderate Democrats are willing to look to vote for a reasonable candidate on the Republican side because their party's gone too far.
Yeah.
Wow. That's so good. Takes courage for sure.
Kendall, what's your vision for Minnesota? If God puts you in that place, what's your vision?
When he does. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
That's good.
You know what? It is going to be it's going to be a haven for all Minnesotans, really. We have people that are leaving Minnesota, not just for Florida, Texas, and Tennessee. They're leaving just to go to the border states, Iowa and South Dakota, just within 5 or 10 miles outside the state they love, the state they've grown up in for generations. So the vision is for us is this, is that we're going to bring this state into a point where we're going to have economic prosperity for everyone. We have the highest tax state in the nation. We know that from just scripture that's not what God wants. So we're going to bring that down so people can prosper, make it easier for young families to get started, make it easier for businesses to compete and be effective. Well, we're going to get our schools back. We're going to have to bring in school choice to make it competitive, but we're also going to bring in vocational education for kids, because all, you know, pathways for success and as Americans is not just college.
That's right.
You know, the trade routes is another way. And so the other one is we're going to make our cities safe again. In October 2009, Forbes magazine rated 25 cities for the best quality of life in the safest city. Minneapolis was number one.
Wow. In 2009,
we're going to bring that back in 24 months.
Let's do it.
And so we're going to have that. And then lastly,
and you know, real quick, people are going to be asking how.
Oh, yeah. Well, here's the scenario. First of all, when men and women sign up to be police officers, they're putting their lives on the line. It's not just a paycheck. They're literally putting their lives on the line. They're not going to do that for city council or mayors that have no respect for police officers. But they'll do that for people that do, and they will sign up, will recruit 500 officers. And because they work for the state, they can be deployed anywhere in the state, including the Twin Cities. Because we're going to get our Twin Cities back.
It's good.
Kendall, you've got a great vision, and it's going to resonate in everyone's heart, I'm sure, even though the political differences are severe within our state. But in a lot of ways, you're offering people for their own personal breakthrough. Look, would you like a breakthrough for safety and for financial prosperity?
For education. I love that. Yeah.
You know what's shocking? People introduce me as this conservative Republican. And listen, my values are. But what they describe used to be considered American. Yeah. My values haven't changed in 30, 40 years. I came from nothing. I wanted to earn a living. I wanted my family to live in a safe community. I wanted my kids to grow up to be independent and contributors to our society. That used to be considered American. The norm. And we're bringing the norm back.
Yes. And if you had 100 people in a room, I guarantee you 95 of those 100 would say, yes, sign me up. That's what I want.
Yeah, exactly.
We all want that for our families. So as we wrap this up, because we could stay on with you all day long, this is just so good to hear from your heart and hear what you're going to be doing here in the state of Minnesota. But what's the biggest misconception about you that you'd like to clear up on this podcast?
There are some people that think I'm a corporate guy. You know, they call it establishment Republican. And because we've had a lot of generous donors that supported our nonprofit and I've come through corporate America. You know, I was an officer. I haven't forgotten my roots. That's the one thing I want people to understand. I haven't forgotten my roots. And the God that I love, the God that I serve, if you do that, you will remain a humble person. You really will. And I was just telling Sheila, last night, I don't want to be in politics a long time, because if Solomon can go the wrong way, the wisest man in the world, he was. I sure can. So I want to do my time and serve our state, serve our country, and get out to a normal life.
That's so good. Humility wins. It really is. Humility and love always wins. Yeah. So thank you for what you're doing, Kendall.
Yeah, and thanks for all the work that you've put into the Prodigal Project and Take Charge, all the work and efforts you put into raising kids and your marriage and all of the other things that transpire within your life. You're a good example, Kendall. Yeah.
I appreciate you a lot.
Thank you. Well, God bless, and here's to 2026.
All right.
Take care.
Thanks.
Take care.
Well, that's a wrap for today's show. We hope you enjoyed it. As always, we love spending time with you right here on Your Biggest Breakthrough podcast. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode. But until then, just head on over to yourbiggestbreakthrough.com, where you'll find some free resources and information and a place where you can comment. And we would love to dialogue with you there. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.